If you are newer to our community, you may not have experienced me doing this particular part of a sermon before. Those of you who have been around in my time have gone through the gauntlet of raise your hand if you such and such. But I think it's a fascinating way of getting more information about what our community is. We do that in a spirit of trust and often playfulness. In many ways, it originated for me with a game that I played with youth. Come to understand that not many youth here played it. But back in Omaha, we did an activity called Step Across or Step Over the Line. Anyone familiar with what that may be? Kathy, Jim, perfect. First service, we were struggling there. So this is an opportunity to find out who's in the room. And someone will ask a question, everyone's kind of lined up, and if it's true for you. And what's great is you don't get to caveat, you don't get to add on, define it, you don't get to speak. If it's true for you, you step across the line. And people kind of take a minute and assess, and then there's another question, and back and forth. Often, when I've done this with youth, we start, and I think in any group it's good to start with kind of the more mundane, are you wearing black? Okay, that one's easy and doesn't necessitate a lot of trust. But invariably, when we're playing this activity, doing this activity with youth, the questions go deep and they go deep fast. We start wrestling with who we are inside and what we think about the world around us. This sanctuary, this place, is where we can do that with some trust, recognizing that it matters really not that we all raise our hands at the same time or for the same thing. So, I'm going to ask some questions. If you feel comfortable raising your hand, I invite you to do so. You can think it in your head. The only thing is you can't give a caveat. So, some of the words will be true, more or less, sort of. If you're like me, a little bit of all of the above. But raise your hand as you feel comfortable. With the pews and stuff, it's hard to do step across. We might go outside and do that sometime. So, we'll start off easy. So raise your hand if you like music. All right, that should have been pretty close to 100%. Raise your hand if you're wearing blue. Okay. Raise your hand if you knew that before I asked the question. Not me. All right, so raise your hand if you believe in God, whatever the definition might be. Put them down. You can put them down. Raise your hand if you believe, I'm being very specific here, not if you don't believe in God, but if you believe God doesn't exist. Those are different things. Good. All right. Raise your hand if you, at different points, believe both of those in some way. Confusion is good. Some ambiguity are in the middle. Raise your hand if you do believe in God, if you think God has an active role in our lives or has an effect on the world. Couple of us, not so. Okay, good, nice. Raise your hand if you think God started life, whether via the Big Bang or otherwise. Okay. Raise your hand if you think God is found in nature. Closer to 100. God is found in science. Yeah, even more. Raise your hand if you think God is found in justice. Okay. Raise your hand if you think God is found in war. Raise your hand if you think God is created by the work of humanity. Raise your hand if you have not raised your hand. There we go. There's always someone that I didn't get with all those. Thank you for being so willing to do that. I don't know about you. I'm in that moment. I don't get a good sense of who raised their hands. Maybe you did or didn't, but what's important as we roll through those questions is what we thought internally. It's good sometimes just to have them tossed out there to recognize, yeah, maybe sort of, no, yes. All of those things exist when it comes to theology and religion and our lives. I found myself on the receiving end of questions not dissimilar from that, but a little bit more in depth. A number of years ago, on the path to becoming a minister, you have to have this interview. And it's not unlike defending your thesis for those who have done that. It's called sort of a fellowshipping circle interview. And so we defend in some way our work and our lives. You start off with a sermon, and it's timed. It can be no longer than 10 minutes. No longer. So some of you would appreciate that. Some of you would start to only listen after 10 minutes. But you have to do that first, and then you sit down for 80 minutes and answer questions. Usually when you're going up to this interview, some of us at least will have a mock. We will do a version of the interview with friends and colleagues who have gone there before, who have read all of our information, and they will kind of toss out questions. And we call it a mock in large part because it feels like there's some mocking going on as we learn to struggle with what we don't know. So I did that little pre-interview with some trusted colleagues, with a professor, and I gave my sermon, which went fine, I think, maybe right at 10 minutes, and answered the questions. I got all of them right. Even the ones I didn't know, I got right just by saying, I don't know. That was exactly what they looked for. And it was okay to be who I was and to think what I thought. At the end, this group, rather than giving a score, which is what the official group does, they just give you feedback. Let me tell you what I noticed and that sort of thing. It mostly went fine until the professor of preaching, David Bumbaugh, you might have met him before. David says in his kind of gentlemanly, scholarly way, Scott, I want to go back to your sermon. That was not a good sign for me. The sermon was the thing I thought I had down well. What in the world could I have done to go back to? He said, I noticed that there was a phrase that you used, God of my understanding, God of our understanding. And my question, not that I think they'll ask this at the MFC, but my question for you is, what about the God not of your understanding? Most of the things that I got asked that day, I had an answer for, even if it was in jest, whether it was pithy or real. I was stunned, shell-shocked. What about the God not of my understanding? I had at this point sort of devoted my life to a faith where I had understood I could worship the God of my understanding, that all of us did in some way. I was glad to know that he didn't think I would get that question at this big interview, but it has stuck with me for some time. Maybe it's one that we can roll around in our heads to start to figure out what that might look like. A few years before that, after a long night at the hospital doing chaplain work, I was on the bus. It was an hour-long trip back to Hyde Park. And after about 30 minutes, a colleague, another student, got on the bus. And I saw her. I tried to keep my head down low. I was tired and not wanting to talk shop. But she saw me. And Leslie came over and sat beside me. I tried to keep it light on the surface like we often do. And she didn't want to. She wanted to know how my night at the hospital was. How's formation going, she would say. I told her a little bit about the night before and that I had experienced God in the night somehow, and she stopped me on the dime. She didn't let me go much further. Scott, how can you talk about God? So at first, I have to admit, I was tired, a little cranky, and I didn't want to get in too deeply. And so I said, well, tell me what you think about God. I just threw it all back on her. She talked for a bit about her views on religion, and then she went on to ask how I could, given my background as a feminist, as someone vehemently against racism and oppression, as someone who embraces postmodernist thought, as an intelligent, rational Unitarian Universalist, she said with her eyes askew, how could you believe in God? She gave me the look that says, come on, we're adults here. We all know that there aren't monsters in the closet or under the bed. There aren't fairies. There aren't this or that. We know, don't we? Yeah, they're not. Well, that was part of the question. I stood there, or sat there actually, before we got up, and we got off the bus and walked back towards our school together, and I talked some about what I meant when I use that word. So that word, the G word, as sometimes we do here in UU churches, the G word, I think, is a word and symbol that has been misused and has so many definitions that when it comes up, we all think many different things. We react to those. There is this apocryphal story, true or not, of Forrest Church hearing someone say, I don't believe in God, after Forrest talked about it. The response to that was, well, tell me about the God you don't believe in, and I'll tell you about the God I do believe in. We all have different definitions and experiences. For me, at least, when I use that word, I talk about all that is uncontrollable. Everything. For me, that means that there is something beyond me that is uncontrollable, and yet it includes me. It means that nature is God, humanity is divine, that relationships I form with others enable me to meet and make God and experience God in a way that I could not do alone. I believe that God, the uncontrollable, is found in the past, the present, and the future. I don't believe in a God that knows all, merely a God that contains all of the knowledge that we share, in part because God is ever evolving by our lives. This God is created in the process of living, not a separate entity from us. But that's my theology. It need not be your theology or anyone else's. And part of what we do when we come to this space together is to sit and wrestle with that a bit, to know that we are not alone. We rely on one another and on our ancestors in the future, truly connecting with those pieces beyond us. I go back to that question about the God not of my understanding, and I think I've got it figured out with the uncontrollable. But maybe there is something sacred and holy that goes beyond that, something I don't quite get today that I might get in the future or that I might understand differently. I may change my mind. This is in part why we come together as a religion. Our society so often now is discouraging people not to take religion or spiritual views seriously. Stephen Carter, the writer of the book, The Culture of Disbelief, offers this. He writes, in contemporary American culture, religions are more and more treated as passing fads rather than as fundamentals upon which we can build our lives. What the culture says is if you believe one thing, but your religion believes another, give it up. Find something different. I think that this can be good for us. In our society, we have too often been shackled to definitions and images of God or church or whatever that do not fit for our authentic lives. It's not fair for us to take something on that speaks against our life and our truth. And at the same time, we cannot believe that we know everything. From moment one, we are always learning and growing, and so what does it mean to keep allowing our definitions to shift and change? Do we have to be comfortable with God? Maybe that's part of what is meant with the God not of our understanding. So what does it mean to sit with that discomfort? Another minister, Scott Alexander, UU minister, offers this. He says, regrettably, many people used to be attracted to Unitarian Universalism because it was the religious path of least resistance. He says, I'll never forget a long conversation I had with a man who had followed his wife into a church I was serving. He was having trouble, like many of us, I'm sure, understanding just what UU was. Anyone felt that before? He's not quite getting it. He was a lapsed and angry Roman Catholic, and he did grasp and appreciate the freedom part of Unitarian Universalism. Refusing to impose any dogma or moral absolutes. He liked that and felt great, he said, to be liberated from all that encrusted orthodoxy. But having been raised in a church where beliefs were imposed from above, not just nurtured from within, he didn't grasp how we challenge each person to be careful, authentic, compassionate, and responsible in their living. With more than a little sarcasm, he writes, this man said, hey, this religion is great, and he slapped him on the back. It's a cakewalk, a Sunday walk in the park. No dogma, no catechisms, no confession booths, no eternal damnation, or no sin. I like this. If I join this church, I just lean back and believe whatever I want. Scott Alexander goes on to say that no matter how often he tried to explain what a demanding, disquieting, lifelong journey it is to be a UU, this guy just didn't get it. Like so many come-outers, people who were in one faith, who came to our church, he was fixated on freedom at the cost of responsible search. He missed altogether the haunting challenge and demanding tension written into the fourth UU principle, that ours is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. To be a UU is to spend a lifetime seeking reality and truth wherever you might find it, and to live in this world in an ethical and principled way. There is nothing casual or easy about that. Why should it be casual or easy? Most of us know that life isn't in any way either of those things. It has its moments, sure, but the way that we live our lives must match the challenges we face. We have these many varied questions which can be hard to grapple with, and we are so often taught by society and by churches that we ought not doubt. We ought not question. Recognize for a moment that in this sanctuary, in this religious community, there is space for us to live in the gray, to be ambiguous, to find confusion in our lives, and that difference is okay. Not just okay, but wanted and preferred. We want a room full of people who raise their hands at one question or the other, or at all of them, struggling on their own life journey. We find ourselves challenged by significant questions, even from an early age, because there are no easy answers. And we recognize that we could not create the world simply as it is in this moment. Originally, I was going to use this call to worship from Evie Seidman. It says this: "It's a good thing that I'm not in charge here." He writes, "I could never have thought of a pine cone or a pomegranate or a porcupine. And even if I had thought of one, how on earth would I have engineered a comet or organized life in a pond? Where would I have found the energy to make each and every snowflake different? It's more like me to come up with one or two passable models, make a mold, and crank them out. It's not like me at all to finish up an entire mountain range and then go back and carefully touch up the tiny forest of moss." So often in our lives, we look around and are faced in wonder and awe at that which surrounds us. We may not know exactly from whence it came. We may not know how it was created. We may see the evolution over time and recognize that science tells us much, but not everything. We look with wonder and awe at the lives that we live and the relationships and families we create. While much can be drawn from that, not everything. There is mystery in the world, something uncontrollable and undeniable. One of the greatest things about being alive and being human is we have this gift to comprehend, to analyze, to reason, and thus to grow. At times it can be infuriating because it haunts us. We struggle when we can't quite figure out the answer, can't quite make sense of the world as we have witnessed it. So we come together, here with one another, with vastly different experiences, and the words, however, of Peter Mayer, casting questions into the deep. That is what we do at church. Not just to sing the same song or perform the same ritual, but to be together, learning a deeper love than we once knew. Whatever it is that exists within us, beyond us, whatever ultimacy there is in the world, we must recognize that we carry some truth of it together. We piece it together, not just in our own image, but in something greater. Anne Lamott, a writer many of us know and like, has this line, you may have heard it before, that you can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do. That's the God not of my understanding. I don't understand sometimes how God could love everything and every person, but maybe I'm not meant to understand. I invite you then not to commit the sin of idolatry, thinking that we have one truth forever and that we must worship that thing, but instead to be open to change, to learning from one another and sharing together that which we know deep in our bones. Alice Walker has a line where she asks, have you ever found God in church? The hide-and-seek story made me think of this. Have you ever found God? I never did, she writes. I found a bunch of folks hoping for him to show up. But any God that I found in church, I brought in with me. And I think that all the other people did too. We come to church, she writes, to share God, not find God. We come to share whatever it is that's holy and sacred about our lives, to share it with one another for justice and peace and a greater sense of love than we could ever know ourselves. May we go forth and share the sacred. Amen, and blessed be.